This is the podcast for March 23rd, 2012. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Congressional Uterus Knitting Circle, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. That's new DuPont Circle, isn't it, Blue Gal?
Well, everyone has sent this to me this week. I have been inundated with people mailing knitted uteri to their Congress people. Uh-huh. And the pattern for this came out a couple years ago. There have been all kinds of subversive knitting movements to yarn bomb tanks that are out there, you know, cover them with knitting or a crochet and cover guns on statues with knitting and all good. Uh-huh. I'm doing something different, which is in addition to these kind of movements. I'm not criticizing this at all. I think it's fine. Uh-huh. But I think it's a waste of yarn to mail it to your congressman. Send him the pattern and tell him instead of being busy getting into your other people's uterus, he should knit his own. There uh-huh. you go. But one of my Twitter friends and face-to-face friends has been knitting hats for Gaza. There's now a movement to knit hats for Doctors Without Borders to send baby hats to Pakistan.
See, that is a good idea.
Yeah. And
that's a really good idea.
There are, we've talked about this a lot, about how many babies are born on Medicaid every year in this country. There was a big announcement because we're having a huge Medicaid crisis here in Illinois. And, you know, it's over half the babies in Illinois are born on Medicaid.
Yep.
And so it's really important to support those babies with a hat or a blanket or a whatever. Hats for the Homeless programs are everywhere.
Uh-huh.
So there's all kinds of ways that you can knit subversively and knit politically and make a difference in the world. And
knit productively.
Yeah.
The thing about the Congressional Uterus Knitting Circle thing, it seems really indulgent. It seems, I'm reminded of when we were at Netroots Nation on the comedy panel. We weren't on the comedy panel, but we somehow got looped into the conversation.
We were in the front seat of the comedy panel, knew everybody on the comedy panel.
Hey, Matt. Hey,
personally, how you doing?
Hey, Andy.
Hey,
that's Blue Gal over there. So it was not exactly.
Yeah.
The distance between dais and audience was fairly small.
Yeah.
But there were all these sort of well-intentioned liberals, as there always are, with these, dude, let's try this. And it was, let's mail diapers to Vitter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was Liz Winstead, although I'm not really sure, who said, okay, that's really just stupid. I don't know that she said that. I'm probably putting words in her mouth. But she said, first of all, nobody remembers what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Secondly, really? And third, and you think that will change his behavior? How?
Yeah, yeah. What
I know
are you
funny
trying
in
to
your
do?
Head? Yeah. But considering the amount of work it would actually require, and what the outcome would probably be, and that nobody would get the joke without a little note explaining it to them, that's really not a very good idea.
Well, I think sending the pattern to your congressman is a great idea.
Oh, that's a fine idea. But actually knitting something and mailing it to someone who doesn't like you, doesn't care about you.
End up in a trash can. You know, it
doesn't really give a shit about, clearly doesn't give a shit about your issues. It's not going to budge them or their staff one iota. However, there are things that will budge people, and we'll talk about that later on. And the whole idea of knitting for people, I know you knit for cancer patients.
Yes, I do. Yep.
And, you know, the idea of taking I just love to brag, you know, as it says on a poster in our house, this is what I do with a string and two sticks.
Yep.
My wife makes something out of nothing and makes sure people who desperately need it get it. And I can't think of a higher, nicer,
cooler. It keeps women who are going through chemo and their bodies are freezing because they're going through chemo. And that's just a reaction to chemo. It keeps their shoulders warm. And that's, you know, makes a difference. So, I'm not bragging about me because lots of women are doing this in my church and lots of people are doing this.
Hats for little baby hats for kids who don't have them.
In Pakistan. I mean, seriously, Doctors Without Borders, you know, when they say they need these and they are putting out a call for this, they need them.
They're not selling them on eBay.
No.
No, they're actually using them. Yeah. So that's the idea of aligning your productive activity with your purpose and not being too indulgent about, wouldn't it be clever if we painted the capital steps blue? Yeah, okay, I don't understand why. Well, let me explain the joke to you. Joke fail right there. Yeah, Let's move on. Anyway, speaking of moving on.
Yeah, well, today we're going to talk about, let me just say, there are a lot of things going on in the news.
Yeah.
The Trayvon Martin case, and we're so proud of those parents and everyone getting involved with that. This is such a seminal moment in American history that the tide is. First of all, it's showing that the Confederacy is such a big part of the problem.
Yeah.
And white men, or I guess this Zimmerman person was actually Hispanic. But people who think they should be the law.
As John Fugelsang said, white Hispanic and yet named after a Jewish folk singer who changed to Christianity after he changed his name. So the line of succession is a little bit confusing. But yeah, it's open. You know, I don't care particularly what category you find yourself in on the census tract. Yeah. I care a lot the fact that you are gunning for brown people.
Yep.
And you think it's open season on them, and you think that's okay.
And the connection between government's evil, government's wrong, government can't do anything, we're going to defund government so that our local governments have to fire police officers, lay off police officers, and then we can become the law.
Yeah.
Because the cops won't do anything, so we're going to go out and shoot the black people walking around our neighborhood with Skittles.
This is every jag off, and mind you, I want to correct verbally correct something from a week or two ago. There are many fine movies that star John Wayne. I do not think John Wayne was a terrible actor. John Wayne was awesome in True Grit. John Wayne kicked ass in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. He was awesome in The Searchers. He was great in Stagecoach.
Yeah.
There are many fine performances in The Shootist. He was wonderful in The Shootist. Many fine performances by John Wayne. But there are way too many conservatives out there who jerk off to John Wayne movies and think if only we lived in the Wild West where everyone took care of themselves and everyone was a rugged individualist. By the way, bullshit. The Wild West was never like that, ever. Yeah. But people who really believe that Red River is the
ideal Americana, yeah.
And that you should just be able to settle your problems with a gun and you win, and the good guys win. And that's just the way it should fucking be. And anything above that level of civilization is socialism and evil and takes away from my ability to create wealth. This is what you get when you start actually implementing crazy shit frontier policies like that. You get idiots with guns who think they can shoot anybody they want because their governor told them they could shoot anybody they wanted, who made them nervous. And the end result is we end up with a national scandal, and we once again look like a third world nut house for the rest of the planet.
Yep.
And beneath all
the NRA still wants these stand your ground laws in every state, even today. Double
and
down.
Right behind all, if you look carefully with your special liberal glasses, behind virtually every one of these travesties, you will see a Confederate flag flying in the background.
Yep.
Every fucking one of them. So for those of you out there, as a brief aside, who get all shirty about what conservatism really is, what does it really mean? I will again reiterate my challenge to debate Andrew Sullivan anytime, anywhere on the past, present, and future of his fucking movement. I don't want to hear from Adam Smith. I don't want to hear from Edwin Burke. I want him to explain to him that the conservative movement in this country is set up to conserve a very particular lifestyle. And that lifestyle is the white, male, Christian conservative point of view that reached its apotheosis during the Confederacy. Period.
Amen. And speaking of things that have reached their apotheosis, because we need to move on.
Let's roll along.
Etch a sketch.
Yeah.
And now we're done.
Yeah. Boom. Done.
And so is the Romney campaign.
Yeah. Well, first, it is the gaffe that spawned 1,000 pieces of brilliant
and
internet.
And a new Photoshop. Yeah. Everyone was going to be Photoshopped that. Yeah.
And if you all would like out there, just for fun, to Google Drift Glass, Ohio Arts, and Etch-a-Sketch. You will see that yours truly was whipping that analogy, exactly that analogy around.
About four years ago, right?
In 2009.
2009, yeah, okay.
Yeah, about this is what their brains are made of. And and you can just shake their heads and they will reset every time. So as I mentioned earlier this week, I love it when conservative spokespeople plunder my archives for their talking points.
Yeah.
But I didn't mean it in a nice way. So apparently, again, this guy tripped over his dick in public and grabbed for the nearest analogy he could find, and it was perfect. It was it was Gerald Ford's last trip. It was Dukakis in the tank.
Yep.
It was that final Sharpie pen underscore to this is what Mitt Romney is. And if you people out there, if you conservatives out there are still voting for this guy, then you fucking well deserve it.
And wait a minute. I want to interrupt you there because Rick Santorum said, and this is quoted on Wonkette, and they've got video of it too. Wow.
Yeah, well.
You win by giving people the opportunity to see a different vision for our country, not someone who's going to be a little different than the person in there. He's talking about Romney. This is Rick Santorum.
Yes.
He's saying that Romney's just a little different from Obama.
Yep.
If you're going to be a little different, you might as well stay with what we have instead of taking a risk with what may be the Etch-a-Sketch candidate of the future. Rick Santorum endorses Barack Obama after the jump.
He does.
And part of this is something we've talked about before, which is Santorum and Gingrich personally hate.
Yes.
Mitt Romney. Hate him.
They really do.
Won't share a cab with him. So
it's
going to be an interesting convention. That's all I have to say.
But, well, I mean, he's Thurston Howell. He really... He's been to the manor born in every way you can imagine. And this is not saying anything new or cutting any new trail here, but he really, every step, every move, every utterance is calculated by consultants to give you the impression that he's not completely uncomfortable with dealing with normal humans. And the creaking of his armor, the creaking of his robotic sentences and his movements and his facial gestures and his words are so completely transparent. It's so clear that he has no concept of how functioning human beings operate outside of the wealth bubble.
Yeah.
And he's doing what you do in business. He's hiring all these consultants to say, basically, make me look normal to the rubes out there so I can get this fucking job. And everyone else in the GOP hates him because he really does have this attitude that it's mine. This is my turn. Everybody get out of the way of my money bulldozer because this fucker belongs to me.
It's what Martin Bashir said that was so brilliant, which is he's Prince Charles. He's been waiting his whole life for this job, and nobody wants him to have it.
Uh-huh.
But he's entitled to it because he's the heir. He's the American heir to the to the throne of America. And that's just so brilliant.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, what we really want to talk about today, and I want to give a little background, if you don't mind, Drift Glass, because you and I have been talking about this since last Friday, that you wanted to do a podcast about jobs, the economy, the workplace, manufacturing, and so forth. And you talked about it with me and said, well, maybe we should make it a bonus, or maybe we should make it a midweek podcast, or maybe we should do something apart from our regular podcast schedule, because it's sort of, for you, it's first of all, it's your passion, and also it's sort of an outlier.
Yeah.
But then, once again, Rick Santorum said this week... I don't care about unemployment. And I looked at that and I went, thank you. Thank you for making this so relevant to today's news.
There are ways to say that sentence that can make it more palatable. Like, I understand how much pain you're in, but there are actually some things that are more transcendently important than the unemployment numbers this week.
This month, yes.
But telling a nation of unemployed people that you don't give a shit about unemployment is world class. It's Etch-a-Sketch level stupid.
Yeah, it is.
It really is.
And so we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about, and also the House passed the quote unquote Jobs Act, which is, we're going to do a top 10 lies about employment and jobs that conservatives promulgate.
And I believe that the jobs bill should be called the Help America Now, Damn It Jobs Bill, or the Hand Jobs Bill, if you will.
Well, I was thinking this is just a please help me pretend that I care about Jobs Act. You know,
yeah, and it really is. It's just so it's so pathetic.
Bipartisan. It's bipartisan. And here's the deal. I read this morning. I'm going to read it and then tell you where it came from.
And so this is the very first lie about Jobs.
Is that the Jobs Act, this Jobs Act, not the President's Jobs Act, but the one that is so bipartisan in Congress, please ignore our 10% approval rating and like us, Jobs Act, which is a pro-Wall Street, pro-banker, pro-bankster act, completely.
Shocking.
Yes.
I'm sitting over here being shocked. You can't see me. I'm in the other room, but my face just went all shocky.
Drop your jaw. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here is the description of it from one website. Bill aims to make it easier for companies to launch initial public offerings and raise capital. And I interrupt that to say, I thought that's what banks were supposed to do, but they're sitting on trillions of dollars in cash that they want to invest at stock market rates rather than lend out at 3%.
They're sitting on a shitload of money they borrowed from you and me, Blue Gal, at 0% interest.
And they want to make Wall Street money off of it. Yes. Economists and policy experts warned that the Jumpstart Our Business Startups, or JOBS Act, is unlikely to create jobs. Many argued its rollback of regulations would only lead to greater instances of financial fraud.
Yeah.
Now, that is from NASDAQ.com.
Yeah.
That's not from Think Progress. That's not from some liberal blog somewhere.
Folks, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You don't have to be Carnack, those of you who don't know that, look up Johnny Carson, to hold every single fucking Republican envelope up to your head and go, oh, deregulation and tax cuts.
Yeah. For billionaires.
Deregulation and tax cuts.
Tax cuts for billionaires.
More tax cuts
yes.
for rich people and deregulation.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you can dress it up in whatever, tart it up in whatever fancy clothes you want and whore it up with all the pretty makeup and lipstick you want. And that's all they ever offer. And as I got to agree with Rachel Maddow's commercial, actually, on MSNBC, which is, we've tried this experiment for 30 years. It's a complete fucking failure. Let's get over the fact supply side does not work and go back to something that does work. And Republicans will not do that. And the problem that we have is the supply side approach, the Reaganomics approach, the deregulate everything and cut everyone's taxes approach is incompatible with a healthy economy. You have to go, as I've said before, it's our nation cannot survive long half fox and half free. You cannot continue to do this nonsense and have the kind of economy that has a vital middle class and a robust manufacturing sector and a very diverse economy employing Americans in decent middle class jobs. You can't have both. And Republicans know that. And their attempt to displace the healthy middle class manufacturing driven economy with this bullshit casino economy failed. It's already failed many times. It failed before the Great Depression. It failed in 2008.
I was going to say, it's what brought about the progressive movement.
It is. It will fail every single time. And the fact that they're still pushing it and the fact that there's still millions and millions and millions of your fellow citizens who will go to the polls and vote for them is a sign of how deeply broken this country is. That kind of – it is – they're pushing flat earthism
yes.
to a country that had to dumb its population down to the point where it would accept flat earthism. That's the Republican approach. Make the voter so stupid they will actually buy this crap over and over again, despite the fact that it bites them in the ass every time. And that's a winning strategy for creating a third world despotism, a third world hellhole, but it's not any kind of country I want to live in. Anyway.
Let's talk about manufacturing. And I think I'm just going to shut up and let you talk about manufacturing for 10 minutes.
Well,
the next two lies. Let me read this.
Yeah.
The lie that the manufacturing sector is irretrievably lost to America.
Yeah.
And the converse of that, which is also told by the same people, which is manufacturing is unnecessary to a stable and vibrant economy.
Yeah.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
Here.
Now I'm going to put my soapbox down and step up on it for a few minutes.
Yep. Go ahead.
The manufacturing base in this country still employs millions and millions and millions of people directly. It also employs tens of millions of people indirectly, because manufacturing has what's called a multiplier. Every kind of job or job sector has an economic multiplier or a job multiplier. Jobs in the service economy, from whether it's banking or flipping burgers or doing hospital mopping floors or cleaning up hotels, those all have multipliers too, but they're all very small. The average multiplier for the service sector is like under one job. The average amount of economic activity that service sector jobs generate is 50 cents on the dollar or 70 cents on the dollar. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with those jobs, but you can't have a nation that has people selling haircuts to each other. It doesn't work. What you need is a sector where wealth is actually created, where new things are actually produced out of raw material, like my wife does with her two sticks and a string. She takes something that is a raw material and produces a finished product and adds value to it through her expertise and labor. This is as old as the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. The manufacturing sector is much, much, much smaller than it used to be. That is absolutely true. But it is also true that your brain is a very small percentage of your body mass. But if you lose it, your body dies. It's exactly the same relationship. Yes, the manufacturing sector is small, but first of all, there's no reason it should get a lot smaller. And there's no reason it shouldn't get larger. I don't know if you all know this, but for example, Chicago used to be, and I think maybe still is, the candy capital of the world. More companies manufactured candy in and around Chicago than any place else on earth.
And the food industry is a huge manufacturer.
It is. It is.
You buy Fruit Loops, those are that's manufactured food.
Absolutely.
They don't grow out there in the wild.
on the Loop farms.
Yes.
despite what the Loop cowboys tell
you. Right, the wild French toast in the fields of France. We have to go harvest it now.
Yeah. Let us go. There are not Loop truffle hogs that go out. No, these are manufactured products, and it's food. But the candy example is a really good one, because the candy industry was big in Chicago, but it grew. And it grew because at some point it reached a critical mass of skilled labor. And if you are out there anywhere in the world and you want to open up a candy company, one of the things you really have to have, since it's such an art to create candy and not just a science, you have to find a pool of skilled labor. And therefore, once you reach a critical mass of certain skills, you begin drawing in people from other places. People start relocating because, well, you got to go here, because if you want to make candy, that's where you got to do it. And more importantly, you start having these wonderful low-level interactions with garage-level inventors, garage-level engineers, people who are tinkering things together or engineering things or dreaming things up, because now they have a community. Now they're not just doing it in isolation. So you have, what if, for example, I'm now going to shift from candy to NASA. How do you like them apples? The idea that if you turn the country's focus to a space program in the 50s, 60s, you would put people on the moon, you'd beat the Russians, and you have all sorts of benefits. All that's true. But you also spun off hundreds and hundreds of products and industries from the inventions created by a population that suddenly had way more engineers and way more mechanics and way more metal workers and manufacturers than they did a generation before. So you created this labor force that's very well trained, highly focused, very entrepreneurial, and love what they do, and you turn them loose. And suddenly you have Tang, and you have Velcro, and you have remote telemetry, and you have cell phones, and you have miniaturization. You have all these things that kept pouring out of this initial investment. There's no way to predict linearly that will happen if you reinvest in the manufacturing sector. But what I can tell you with an absolute certainty, that if you don't save the manufacturing sector, this country is fucked. Because once it's gone, it's gone. You can't rebuild that critical mass while everyone else is trying to take it away from you. And it's still savable. It's still salvageable. There's still clusters of companies all over this country that have that right mix of land use and transportation and expertise and so on. But what they desperately need is government investment, not welfare, not handouts. What they need are decent roads and rail, to move their shit to market. Mm-hmm. What they need are people to come in and help the owners, who are probably approaching 60, 70, 80 years old in a lot of cases, help them figure out how to sell their company to the employees or sell them to someone who will keep that productive enterprise going, as opposed to just gutting it and dropping it for the real estate value, and another small company in your neighborhood just disappears along with 50 good jobs.
Ask you something? Because one of the things that really frightens me about these kind of conversations is how much money the Chinese government is losing every year on solar energy. Because they want to be, when the technology catches up with the price, which is going to, Bill Clinton says that's going to happen in 5 years. It's not 50 years down the road.
Always happens. It always happens.
They want to be the only one you can go to buy solar cells.
Yeah. Well, remember, the first desktops were $2,500.
Yeah.
And they had less power than my wristwatch does. Yeah. And the price always drops. Once you hit scale and once the technology becomes replicable and easy and the breakthroughs are made and it becomes a matter of engineering it more efficiently and building it more cheaply.
When it becomes new housing automatically has solar panels on the roof.
Yep.
Which is going to, like, it has pipes underneath the house.
Yeah.
And that becomes part of the structure.
And once it becomes,
and that's going to happen.
Once that becomes built into your mortgage, so you can amortize the cost over 30 years and you don't have to pay for everything up front. Right. No, this is what everybody who's in a price war, from Walmart to the local gas station at least, used to do, which was you undercut your competition, you take the loss up front, you drive your competition out of business. This is how monopolies operate. Yeah. And once your competition is out of business, you own the fucking market, and you'll own it forever because the price of getting back into that market is so goddamn high. Nobody wants to do it.
And that's the thing, that the Chinese have dozens and dozens of solanders going on.
Yes, they do. And they don't have
they don't care.
They don't have a bunch of Republicans throwing cinder blocks into traffic time they make a mistake. Right. China makes lots of mistakes. There's uninhabited cities they've built in China. There's an entire fucking airport the size of O'Hare that's unused because they just built it wrong, and it's sitting out there either waiting for use or people driving by it. They have made huge numbers of mistakes. But what they absolutely did is exactly what this country did during World War II. They made a massive nationwide industrial government commitment to dominating this industry.
Right.
We're going to put 10,000 tanks in Europe next year. We're going to darken the skies with aircraft next year. And we're going to double it and double it and double it because we have to, or we're going to lose. That is their mentality. Our mentality is, well, you know, the government shouldn't pick winners and losers. You know, just let the market do what the market does. Well, you know, just if you were a better entrepreneur, if you worked better, well, if unions weren't such fucking dicks, then maybe this wouldn't happen. You know what? There are merits to every one of those arguments, but those are tiny tactical distractions compared to the strategic war in which we are engaged. And it's a war we can win. We can be a manufacturing – we are a manufacturing powerhouse. The United States exports more than anybody else. We're more productive per man hour, I do believe this is still correct, than anybody else. Germany pays a shitload higher, and they somehow manage to love their country. Germany puts union members on their goddamn boards because we told them to when we rewrote their constitution. And they seem to be getting along just fine. The problem we have in this country is that we have a supply-side mentality on the Republican Party that is sabotaging every attempt to get back what we lost.
Yep.
And so going back to government investment, another thing you need government for, in addition to roads and bridges and cops and water and land use and fighting for you during a trade war, being on your side, not giving tax cuts to people who shut companies down, Mitt Romney, but giving tax cuts to people who keep jobs here. Let the market decide, but for God's sakes, let the market play fair. Don't side with people who want to rip the copper tubing out of this country and sell it and leave us all bereft. And most importantly, what you need is a massive government investment in education and training.
And that goes back to two of our other lies that I want to just check off, which is business needs government out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's some merit in that argument, in the same sense that tobacco does in fact lower the incidence of certain diseases in the sense that it kills you before you get those diseases. Yeah, technically that's true, but it's such a bullshit, trivial, it's such a fucking weaselly argument.
Well, and it's such a lie, too, because you know who really loves government money and who the last welfare queen's going to be?
Wall Street.
Wall Street and defense contractor manufacturers,
yeah,
like Boeing,
yeah,
who manufacture things, North like North airplanes.
Uh-huh.
And they love government money. They love government. They depend on government investment.
Well, you remember before the Iraq—
I'm not arguing for more defense spending.
No.
I'm just saying they are spending millions of dollars on lobbying to make sure that government spending for business is maintained.
And you remember that before the Iraq War— There were lobbyists and industry parties, manufacturing and oil industry groups meeting in D.C. under the tutelage of White House
Dick Cheney canapes, absolutely.
Who were telling them how they can best essentially rip off the taxpayer. Here's the best line you can stand in to get government money for your stupid product. Here's the best way you can feed at this trough. This was being done by small government people. And you know what? The idea that, again, this is the Confederate flag flying in the background. Yeah, the idea that you can just vote this away, that you're some fucking hick and you just go, I'm just so sick and tired of being ripped off on both sides. If we could just get government off our backs, you know what? That's never going to happen. Never, ever, ever going to happen. In a nation of 300 million people, this complex, in a modern economy, in a modern world, with as many things that are coming to a head in terms of oil shortage, water shortage, depletion of natural resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, a long-ass list. The idea that you're going to just vote yourself back into some agrarian fantasy land that never existed in the first place, and that's your solution to every problem, you need to remove yourself from the democratic process because you're crazy. That's never going to happen. And if you try to make it happen, what you end up with is fucking Rick Santorum for president.
Yeah.
And that's a disaster. Anyway, I did my shtick about manufacturing.
I want to talk about the 40-hour work week. You found a really good article by Sarah Robinson about the 40-hour work week.
It was wonderful. It was a wonderful article.
Talk about it.
Well, Sarah Robinson used to write for Ornicus. I'm sorry. I want to pronounce that correctly. She's a very good writer. This was to be found on Alternet, and
that's
sure
– Dave Nyward's blog also. Yeah.
And she's a really good writer, and she was talking about how much less productive people are after 40 hours. How the idea that you can drive people 60, 70, 80 hours a week, to increase productivity, to increase essentially decrease your labor costs by overworking your workforce, actually is destructive. It costs you in terms of loss of productivity because people just get tired and distracted and loopy after a certain amount of time. The morale is bad. I'm probably putting that word in her mouth. But just generally speaking, the idea that you're going – that a sustained commitment to working way more than 40 hours a week – and she has all kinds of studies that she cites in there from business organizations and business lobbies that say, yeah, once you hit this certain point, actually it costs you money.
Yeah, shorter work hours increase productivity. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And she, yes, the title of the article is Americans Are Being Worked to Exhaustion, which is perfectly true. And she's A, absolutely right. I completely agree with her. And B, bless her heart, she completely misses the point of why people are being worked to exhaustion. Being worked to death in the workplace is not a function of a rational person sitting down and doing time motion studies and human exhaustion studies and figuring out, you know, I believe that perhaps if we lowered everyone to 35 hours a week or 37 and a half hours a week, we'd have a more productive workplace. No, that's not how any workplace I ever worked in worked. My experience is entirely that. There's a quote in the article where she says, when your boss comes to you and asks you to work 50 hours, you'll work 55. And my response was generally, I can't remember the last time I ever had a boss who came to me and asked me anything.
Yeah.
You know, nobody asks anybody in the workplace. Maybe in academia that happens. I don't know. But in every workplace, almost every workplace I've ever worked in and everyone I know has worked in, the idea of a certain number of hours a day and then you go home is a fantasy. Your boss simply loads up your desk with every piece of project, flotsam and jetsam, that they need to unload off of their desk. And the standard argument that you get from every boss I've ever had, the bad ones, let's just say, when you approach them and say, look, I can't possibly do all of this work. I simply, there's no way to do it. See, once you leave the piecework world, when it's widgets per minute, mm-hmm. and you enter the pushing paper, project management, grant management, personnel management, even technology world, all time estimates fly out the window. And the standard fallback position of every bad manager I ever had was maybe if you were a better manager, maybe if you were a better project manager, maybe if you manage your time better. Well, no, what you've given me is physically impossible to do in the time that exists, much less 40 hours a week. I couldn't do this 120 hours a week. I couldn't possibly do all this work. And from the point of view, you're dealing with a situation where you're in someone else's economic thrall. Your mortgage depends on them not firing your ass. Yeah. So they can dump and dump and dump on you till you collapse. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you're exhausted or being productive, et cetera. It has to do with them going to their boss and saying, I did my job. I delegated this to so-and-so. And so-and-so is just a bad employee, not doing their job, not pulling their weight. They're not a team player.
Well, and this player, gets related to unions, and we should not to move too quickly.
No.
But I keep thinking about the big box stores and the big box hardware stores mm-hmm. that lock people into their building. Yeah. And one of our top 10 is unions are either all good or all bad.
Yeah.
And we've heard from Mr. Romney this week that the sole purpose of education reform is to get those teachers' unions and put them out of business. Mm-hmm. And talk to me about unions now, because this is totally related to that. There are union rules about hourly wages, and there are union rules about things. Now, obviously, if you're in a management position, as you are talking about, there's different ways things are handled.
Absolutely. And
working mid-level managers to death is something that just happens.
Yeah, and once you become this is the great trick of the reengineering world of the 70s.
Make everybody salaried.
Everybody's a salaried. Everybody's an associate. Everybody's an assistant manager. Everybody's a project manager. No, it just means nobody has union protection anymore. Yeah. And I've been the boss before. I've been the boss in several places, and I've had timesheets every week that are like clockwork. 8 to 4, 8 to 4, 8 to 4. Not a minute over and under. I mean, punch cards that track every minute exactly to the minute, because the person worked for a union.
Yeah.
And that was their contractual agreement. And they did good work. They did perfectly good work. I was very happy that they were doing the job they were doing. They did great. I never had any problems. Over on the other aisle, there was another union employee who was horrible. He was the poster child for every noxious fantasy of what a union person
abusing the system
caricature is. And I bent over backwards for this guy. I called him up in the morning. I practically got him out of bed because he said he couldn't make it to work on certain days because it was just too much work. And he slept at his desk. And we measured the air temperature around his desk because he insisted it wasn't his problem. It was the ambient temperature that was causing him to fall asleep. And I went to the wall for this guy over and over again, to the point where the shop steward –
I was going
to
say, your union people were embarrassed by this.
My union people, during his umpteen millionth disciplinary hearing, said, do you realize this guy here, she said, pointing to me, is trying to save your job? Why aren't you cooperating? I mean, all he's asking you to do is basically show up to work on time
and stay awake during work hours.
You know, don't come in at 10 a.m., shovel a pizza into your face and fall asleep for 3 hours. And he just looked with these great sad eyes and it was like, no, that's just too much. I can't do that. Well, then you should be on disability. No, I can't do that either because I need the money. And only through the grace of God and a reorganization and a miracle, this guy get pried out of his desk and put back into the unemployed labor force where he belonged. But both of these people were union guys. And let me tell you, and the moral of the story is, when it came to, as Nixon used to say, nut cutting time, I was the one who got tossed.
Yeah.
The people who had union protection, good or bad, kept their jobs. And the people who had union protection and were good at their jobs, goddamn well deserved to be protected.
Yeah.
Because what I learned the hard way over and over and over again is once you're in management, man, this is another one of our lies and myths, the myth of the meritocracy.
Yeah.
when in a disturbingly large number of jobs I've held, being good at your job has nothing to do with keeping your job. Yeah. In fact, there is an actual inverse proportion going on there. The number of people I have worked with who are staggeringly incompetent and who hang on to their jobs and are promoted, I might sort of step outside of the work world and say, look at the New York Times.
Yeah.
Look at the Washington Post. Look at your media all around you, boys and girls. Look at all the people in the media, from Mark Halperin to David Gregory to Tom Friedman to David Brooks to David Frum to Andrew Sullivan. And ask yourself, my goodness, there's an awful lot of really, really talentless hack people who have done their jobs very badly over the last, say, 10 or 15 years. How come they are on television every week? How come they are well paid? Where are the competent people who weren't fucking wrong about everything in this mix? And the answer is, their job has nothing to do with being right. They're pleasing some other constituency. And it's really important in the workplace to understand what your workplace really does. And an example I use here is Scooter Libby.
Yeah.
Scooter Libby's job was to be Dick Cheney's creature.
And Fall Guy. Yeah.
And Fall Guy. And he did that job really well. His job wasn't to serve the country. He was a traitor. He was a liar. And he should be in federal prison right now. And the reason he's not is that the Bush administration, like many governments, Democratic and Republican, I'll be perfectly frank about that, value loyalty ever so much higher than they value competence. Scooter Libby was loyal. He was a traitor, but he was loyal. So the minute he got in trouble, Dick Cheney went ballistic that George Bush wouldn't pardon him. Now, he committed unpardonable acts, but that had nothing to do with the standards by which Scooter Libby was being judged. And you scale that down into your workplace and you find, for example, under the myth of a meritocracy, I'm going to read you just this very, very brief thing from Carol Marine, the wonderful reporter Carol Marine in the Sun-Times, talking about Tony Preckwinkle. Tony Preckwinkle was a very good alderman in Chicago who was a staunch, upright, very hardcore. She was one of the original opponents of Barack Obama, didn't like where he was coming from. She really proved her mettle in city council. She knew her budgets.
She's a Democrat.
She's a Democrat. Well, everybody.
Everyone in Chicago is a Democrat.
Every alderman but one in Chicago is a Democrat. No, she was a reform, tough as nails, smart as hell, progressive Democrat. And she ran for the president of the Cook County Board, and she won. And she beat little Todd Stroger. And just as a little bit of background, Todd Stroger is the incompetent hack political son of John Stroger, who was the president of the Cook County Board forever. And the Stroger family and the Daley family go way back.
And the Strogers owned Cook County.
Yeah.
And while the mayor owned the city of Chicago. Yeah. Chicago's in Cook County, but county government is different from city government.
It's a puppet.
They're all little fiefdoms.
And they're all multi-generational hereditary monarchies.
Yeah.
You know, one Alderman Ike Carruthers went to jail for the same crime his dad, Alderman Ike Carruthers, had committed a generation before. Rod Blagojevich would be nowhere if it weren't for his father-in-law. The Jackson family are three generations deep, and they're everywhere in Illinois. This is absolutely how Illinois politics works. It's dynastic, it's multi-generational, and if you're not a member of the fucking club, you're not nothing. And this is where loyalty counts more than anything else in certain jobs, in a lot of jobs. Tony Preckwinkle, I'm going to read from this article from the Sun-Times by Carol Marine. Preckwinkle is no political novice. A bunch of Tony Preckwinkle's candidates, so the people she backed in the last in the primary just a few days ago, lost.
Okay, let's just back up for a minute because Tony Preckwinkle actually beat Todd Stroger, beat the dynasty.
She did.
And became president of Cook County Board by challenging the son of the king of Cook County, the prince. Todd Stroger, who's corrupt. I mean,
who is thoroughly corrupt.
Yeah.
Who is,
and she on a clean government platform beat him.
Did. Totally.
And became the cleaner upper of
Todd's
Cook
mess.
Of Cook
and
County.
Todd, and I leave it to the audience to do your own homework on Todd Stroger a little bit, but really, just grotesquely larding up the payroll, putting a bunch of losers on short-term contracts, plundering the place for his personal friends, and just a wisp of a human being, a tiny little squeaky-voiced nobody who would never be anything other than a paper hat employee
if he weren't the son of John Stroger's kid.
Because that's how it fucking works, boys and girls.
And so she beat him.
She beat him.
And now...
And a bunch of her candidates that she sponsored lost, which happens in primaries all the time. Preckwinkle, Carol Marin writes, is no political novice. She spent years in Chicago City Council and ousted incumbent county board president Todd Stroger in 2010. That victory alone earned her credibility as a reformer, which is all true.
Yeah.
But even though she resoundingly and unapologetically defeated the son, she explained to me why she remained loyal to John Stroger, Todd's dad and predecessor, even though he was a machine man and she was a progressive. And mark this sentence, boys and girls, is really important. It had to do with loyalty. When Preckwinkle was a young graduate student, the elder Stroger took time to tutor her in the ways of the toughest game in town. She never forgot that.
So she is loyal to the dad of Todd Stroger, the guy she beat.
Who died.
He
had a stroke and he died. And that's part of the reason Todd Stroger even won the election. He was heading toward the loss and suddenly...
Sympathy vote, yeah.
It's a pity vote, sympathy vote, you know, holding my father's legacy in my arms kind of thing. But she... And this happens all the time. And this is where another sort of sub-rule of finding your way through the workplace and the lies of the workplace is find yourself a goddamn mentor.
Yeah.
Whatever job you're in, not a trainer, not a training provider, not a technician who can show you how the machine works, find yourself someone to teach you the secret rules in your workplace, because there always are secret rules in your workplace. And this omission on my part has cost me careers several times, because I didn't realize that there was this whole secret set of rules over here that nobody ever told me about. And I went zooming along into a brick wall I didn't even know was there many times. And so understand – in the workplace, and this is a very good sort of mid-level management example, your loyalty to what the boss's passions are and what they want you to do, and your willingness to fall on hand grenades, your willingness to shove other people out of the boat, and your willingness to do his or her dirty work for them completely outweighs your facility with a machine or with technology or with people or with spreadsheets or with anything.
Yep.
And that's...
And related to this, may I read this wonkette?
Please. Yeah.
It's a guessing game. Who is the most nepotistic member of Congress? This is a congressman who paid out a total of $305,000 almost in salaries and almost $49,000 for services during the 2008 and 2010 election cycles from his campaign committee and his political action committee to his daughter, his daughter's mother-in-law, his brother, his grandson, his granddaughter, another granddaughter, and a grandson-in-law, making this member of the House of Representatives the most nepotistic member of Congress by volume of family members on the campaign dole. And that's only from 2008 and 2010. And he has that many people on his dole.
I've already seen the instructor's copy of the test, so it wouldn't be fair for me to test. But let's build excitement.
Oh, yeah. I'm just going to tell everybody. It's Ron Paul.
It's Ron Paul.
No wonder, and as Wonkette says, no wonder he always runs for president. He's got to keep his family employed. And, you know, you can argue, and I'm sure Ron Paul would argue, look, this isn't taxpayer money. This is campaign money.
Sure.
But I said this before, and I'm going to keep saying it. If people have money to flush down the toilet, if people have $10 million to flush down the toilet for Newt Gingrich for president, and there is that kind of wealth in America to pay over $400,000, almost $400,000 to the kids and grandkids and in-laws of Ron Paul.
Yep.
fuck you talking about austerity to Social Security recipients.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Uh-huh.
There is no room to be talking about austerity to anybody who is beneath a certain income level. It, like the Paul Ryan budget does.
Uh-huh. Which is
apparently
entirely...
it's giving $174,000 in tax cuts to every millionaire in America. And we've got money for that. But we don't have money for Head Start.
Well, Paul
Fuck
Ryan is...
you.
Paul
That's
Ryan
all I have to say.
Paul Ryan is loyal to his master.
Exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely dog loyal. And that's why he will get elected and reelected. Hey, Scott Walker.
No kidding.
You know, when he thought the Koch brothers were on the line, he sat up like a little doggy and obediently listened to what they were saying. Please understand, every one of these guys works for somebody, but they don't work for you. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we have this amount of money sloshing around in the system for funding crackpot crazy shit ideas that have failed over and over and over again, and yet they will not stop trying to implement them. And every time one of them fails, it's always, well, we didn't go far enough. George Bush wasn't a real conservative. We never really had a real conservative in the White House. We just didn't go far enough. That kind of lunatic Army dead-ender mentality has a shitload of money behind it.
Yep.
And please understand, that's what drives so many decisions that we all take for granted. It's some billionaire somewhere writing checks for crazy-ass ideas and people – at think tanks inventing clever sentences to sell them to morons.
Yeah, and calling it a Jobs Act or calling it clear skies or whatever you're going to do. And they get paid $300,000 a year to do that, to market these things. It's absurd.
And it's a business. And this is why looping it all the way back to Willard Romney.
Yeah.
Willard Romney is this is where it has to do with business. Willard Romney is a vulture capitalist, a data-driven takeover artist.
Yeah, delivery
whose job
system.
Job was to come into your company, take it apart, sell off the parts he could for cash, fire the liabilities, which were the people, and then ship the rest overseas.
Yep.
And make a lot of money doing it. And the way you do that is by telling the people who are the decision makers of that company, the people who can actually let him in the door. It's like the old fashioned vampire mythology. You have to con them into letting you in the door.
Yep.
The Vorvlekken has to be invited into your home. So the trick is convincing, and I've worked for companies like this. This, again, looping back to understanding what your company really does for a living. I worked for a lot of companies, I'll pick a name out of a hat, where we thought we were in the insurance business, but really we were in the keeping Wally, making sure Wally keeps his job business.
Yes. And somebody's nephew. Yeah. Yeah.
And it turned out Wally was perfectly willing to sacrifice the entire company and fire everybody on the IT staff, for example, to save his own fucking job. And he found a consultant who would come in and make that happen for him.
Sure.
And that consultant was just like Mitt Romney. Find that weak point. Find that decision maker who's terrified of the future or wants to make a few extra bucks or whatever. Convince them that you can save them or save their little pot or save their little kingdom or save whatever they value most in this world. You tell them whatever the fuck you need to tell them. And then you get in the door and implement your playbook, which is always the same. Mitt Romney is that guy. Therefore, when it comes to being an Etch-a-Sketch candidate, I truly believe that he is simply making a rational, data-driven business decision. He has looked at what the Republican base is willing to swallow directly from the sphincter of Rush Limbaugh for 30 years. And he has concluded very rationally, these people are morons.
Yeah.
They will believe anything. Oh, my God. Everything they said during the Clinton administration, they reversed themselves on in the Bush administration. And they re-reversed themselves on in the Obama administration. And they never batted an eye. They listen to liars all day long, every day on Fox News. And they
don't
love
remember
it.
What they heard yesterday.
And they love it. They sop it up with a biscuit. So why wouldn't I lie to them? Why wouldn't I change my mind every few minutes every time the wind shifts? They buy this shit.
Well, that's your post about the Etch-a-Sketch was exactly about that from 2009, which is we just shaken him. George Bush is no longer even an issue. And we can worship Ronald Reagan as our standard bearer, who raised taxes and cut and run on the military and did all the no. Etch-a-Sketch time, and that your post was about their brains being Etch-a-Sketch. Yeah. It's not Mitt Romney that's an Etch-a-Sketch.
Their brains.
It's their brains that are people that vote Republican whose brains are Etch-a-Sketches.
Yes, I think I said stuffed with the aluminum powder that the good people at Ohio Arts uses for Etch-a-Sketches, and they just shake their brains every couple of months, and suddenly George Bush doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
The Iraq War was
not
my idea.
Well, he wasn't a real conservative.
For that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you look at him like, oh my, you don't really? And as a rational takeover artist, as a rational, cold-blooded corporate killing machine, you look at the GOP and you say, "What? Lying constantly works."
Yeah.
It's what props up Fox News. It's what props up Rush Limbaugh. It's what propped up the Republican Party and every major player, every major macher in the party for the last 30 years. So why the fuck wouldn't I just take that perfect strategy they've used for 30 years and run it out to its logical conclusion? Lie every day, all the time, about everything. Because you know what? The right will never call me on it, because once you start poking around in the lie hole, all kinds of weird shit comes out of there. Like, didn't you vote for this shit? The Republicans will reliably never talk about the past. And what Mitt Romney can also count on is the David Gregorys of the world. Every time he tells a lie, what will David Gregory do? But the Democrats.
Yeah.
He will automatically. The centrist media are absolutely fucking wired. Every time a Republican lies, to invent an imaginary hippie and impute to that hippie exactly the same character flaws, and like Chris Matthews did this week, and nobody slaps that fucker upside the head and said, prove it. Name me one goddamn name where this is true. Nobody dares to say that, because if they do, the whole house of cards falls
apart. And I don't want to leave this topic without discussing Andrea Mitchell.
Yeah, okay.
Because of her ad for MSNBC, which is supposed to be, you know, the liberal media.
Liberal media.
And what did she say in her ad? That she was she was outraged.
She was so tired of political parties and interest groups trying to suppress the vote of people.
Yeah, political parties. It's an outrage that political parties, plural.
Uh-huh. And she
tried to suppress voting.
This is not something she shot off the top of her head.
This is scripted.
A piece of advertising copy that had to make it through at least two or three levels of editorial decision making before it got on the air.
It's all these MSNBC personalities talking about, you know, Rachel Maddow talks about Social Security, and you know, Chris Matthews talks about John F. Kennedy and World War II, and Reverend Al talks about blueberry pie.
But
Andrea Mitchell says political parties, plural, are suppressing the vote.
Yeah.
And gets away with it.
And this is Mrs. Alan
Mrs.
Greenspan. Because she can't say Republicans are to blame or she would lose her job. And David Gregory would lose his job. Mark Halperin would lose his job. The minute one of these fuckers opens their mouth.
I think it's the other way around, though, now, Driftglass. I think these are all Republican plants, Republican stooges, people whose jobs in the belt, whose lifestyle in the Beltway depends upon both sides do it.
Oh yeah,
and I don't think it's that I can't possibly say the truth because I'll lose my job. I embrace this. Uh-huh. I embrace this as my job. This is my job.
But and this is where you and I will have to respectfully disagree, Blue Gal. I agree with that up to a certain point, but at some point, this is the water they swim in. So they don't even notice it anymore.
Right, right.
But at some point, someone, somewhere, because it's so clearly a lie, someone somewhere or someone's somewheres are making a conscious decision to exclude from the conversation any voice that would bring any facts to the table.
Yep, yep.
And that person, whoever the hell that person is a person who's saying, I don't dare let a real liberal on television because he will make David Gregory look like the fucking tool that he is. And again, I will repeat Andrew Sullivan. I don't dare debate Driftglass anywhere, anytime, because he will make me look like the Tory stooge that I am. And I'm not going to risk that. My whole shtick is playing this centrist bullshit game, and I'm not going to let anybody on the stage who might screw that up. And that they might believe it, but the exclusion of alternate voices, the exclusion of anybody who will confront them on this on a factual basis, is a decision, a conscious decision made by someone somewhere.
And there's a reason why the Occupy movement therefore does mic check,
yeah.
which is to break into that
yep.
and simply scream it, because there's no other way to get the voice on the stage except to stand up and break in.
Yeah, and then, of course, you're shrill. And
then you're shrill and you're marched out, you know, you're frog marched out of the building, but you've been heard.
And, you know, Michael Moore is fat.
Well, and Bill Maher said something mean 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So,
again,
enough. I want to make sure we cover two other things. We don't have a lot of time left, but I don't think we have to debunk the lie that government jobs aren't real jobs. I think people kind of – our listeners get that.
No.
Also, the idea that you – the last one is you can be pro-family and expect people to take 300-mile commutes.
Yeah. yeah.
And
yeah.
that adults in minimum wage jobs can be part of your economic plan and you're pro-family.
Permanently.
Permanently.
That
forever.
Built into your vision of the economic future for this country is a permanent – low wage, long commute, starving underclass. Yep. And if that's factored
in
as
you can be pro-family and believe that children should be janitors in their own schools.
Yeah.
And you're a family candidate.
There's a place for a minimum wage job, if you want to call it that, for interns, for student workers, for people who are truly indeed in transit between here and there. I believe there's a place for a part-time minimum wage or seasonal job for people who are in transition between here and there. But if your economy has gotten to the point where you are expecting millions and millions of people to live forever on $9 an hour.
And corporations are depending on government spending to subsidize the wages of of their employees with Medicaid, as Walmart does.
Well, Walmart, I will give you this one story, and I will leave it at that. Walmart is even more insidious than that. Walmart once backed, to my knowledge, it might have done this more than once, but backed an increase of the minimum wage to a certain point. And that was because their analysis showed that was the price point above which someone might shop at someplace other than Walmart. But below that point, people would spend all their money at Walmart. So they're perfectly willing to increase the wage to $10.15.
Because they'll come to Walmart and spend all their food stamp money. Yes.
That's just poor enough that you have no place to go other than Walmart. Anything above that, they're against. And that's how calculated and insidious corporations can be.
I bet they paid the author of that study hundreds of thousands of dollars to find that out.
I'm sure they did. And you know what? They are amoral. Yeah. Corporations are amoral, profit-producing
machines.
Monsters. They're machines. They're sharks.
And that's not a bad thing if you don't treat them like people. The role of government is to tell them to stop.
Exactly.
Where to stop.
Regulation, setting the goalposts, and punishing them when they do wrong rather than
taking
their
money. When they lock their employees in the office.
Yeah.
And when they treat them like slaves.
Rather than taking their money under the table to rewrite the rules to make their immorality legal.
Yep.
That's where government is supposed to be, and that is not where our government is now.
The end.
Very good.
Clear. And we're clear. We want to thank our listeners. You can listen to our podcast for free at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. We're at our Facebook page, and we are now posting links at our Facebook page to some of these articles. If you're looking for links to the things we've been talking about, they'll be at our Facebook page. I'm Frances Langham on Facebook. We're on iTunes, and our fabulous app is available at the iTunes store. We're also working on an iPad app. Our fabulous developer, Marlene, is working on that. We sent her some graphics this week, so watch this space for that.
Yep.
We're on the amazing Stitcher Radio, and we are on Netroots Radio, netrootsradio.blogspot.com, from 6 to 7 Pacific, 9 to 10 Eastern. You can contribute to the podcast. I particularly want to thank those of you who give $5 a month, and that is an option at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. You $5 contributors who are supporting this podcast with $1.25 or less per podcast are actually now paying our internet cable bill. And that just blows me away. Thank you for doing that. That makes that not a luxury. It's actually a business expense for us now. And so we won't be canceling internet and TV and cable TV, you know, to make ends meet because you're supporting that. And you're supporting this podcast very directly by doing that. And thank you, thank you, thank you so much. You can contribute at our website. You can also contribute, if you don't like using computers to transfer money, at our P.O. Box. And we love hearing from you there, too. Our P.O. Box is P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. That is at our website also. Our email address is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Write to us anytime. We love to hear from you.
Even while being aware that if you write to us at our address, we do reserve the right to read your mail on the air unless you say otherwise.
Yes. We have an Internet Kitty at our website and our Facebook page every week. The Internet Kitty this week is also a lap kitty and a laptop kitty. This is Busy Monkey. I guess is the kitty's name. The name of the photo is Busy Monkey. So she's between a lap and a laptop in this photo. And so we'll be posting that on her website. And we're very grateful to you for sending your Internet Kitty photos to us. We've had a few dog submissions, which I'm going to put up all the dogs next week at the Facebook page, because they're honorary Internet Kitties.
Yeah.
And we love the dogs as well. But the Internet Kitty this week is Cassidy is the name. Cassidy is also nicknamed Monkey and eats several hundred dollars of food, I'm being told. So, and she's between a lap and a laptop, Cassidy is. So we'll be posting that today. And thank you so much for sending your Internet Kitty photos. We love all the Internet Kitties.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And speaking of that, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, the Internet Kitties can prove with a birth certificate that they are indeed Ron Paul's nieces.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2012. Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.